difference.
All right, before we begin, I want to make sure, does everyone have a Bible? Or is close to one? Or you have it memorized so you don't need it? All right, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. Our sessions this week, general title, Let Us Begin to Commence to Start. And trying to work with the theme for the summer, Beginning Together, and looking at different understandings of beginning and the sense of beginning that is there, the ways of the beginning of God's grace, the beginning of the gospel, how God enables beginnings for us. And today we're going to talk about beginnings that start in a negative kind of way. And so that's why it starts with dead stumps. And we're going to take a look at beginnings there. So for our... supposed to say something about me, right? I'm Michael Pellett, and I am the pastor of King of Glory Lutheran Church in Saskatoon, and I am also a professor of philosophy and teach at the University of Saskatchewan. And that's more than enough. Rather dull. So let's take a look at a dead stump. And if you would please turn to Isaiah chapter 6, verses 9 to 13. And Isaiah chapter 6 is the chapter that talks about the call of Isaiah. And those first 8 verses are that vision of call that Isaiah has. Probably for all you worker bees, this happened the same way. Here you were on a Sunday morning sitting in your congregation, the Lutheran Church of Perpetual Guilt, and all of a sudden this vision came to you, right, of God in God's holy temple and in the heavens, and saying, who will go for me, who will serve during work week at Boulder? And you said, here am I. Send me, send me.
Actually, and that was Peg.
Here you are.
Where are they? Send them, send me.
There we go. Right? And so that's the first 8 verses, right? Ending with Isaiah volunteering. Very end there of verse 8. Here am I, send me. And so, right, once God has got the volunteer, then comes the assignment.
But he wasn't willing. He wasn't entirely willing, initially.
Initially, no. But the vision helped. Then God comes in and says, verse 9, God says, go and say to this people, and I'm reading here from the NRSV, keep listening, but do not comprehend. Keep looking, but do not understand. Make the mind of this people dull, or literally it's make the heart of this people fat, and stop their ears and shut their eyes, so that they may not look with their eyes and listen with their ears and comprehend with their minds and turn and be healed. Right. What a mission. And of course Isaiah says, how long, O Lord? And God responds, until Cities lie waste without inhabitant, and houses without people, and the land is utterly desolate. Until the Lord sends everyone far away, and vast is the emptiness in the midst of the land. Even if a tenth part remain in it, it will be burned again like a terebinth or an oak, whose stump remains standing when it is felled. And then that very last line, which doesn't seem to fit at all. The holy seed is its stump. Right. Or even there, it's not really even truly a sentence, right? We just simply try to make it into a sentence, that all we have here simply is, literally, if you would translate it, all you have is holy seed from stump. There you go. That's it.
Maybe these verses should be started with the desolation over here, with all the stumps and whatever from the fire.
Yeah.
And that's a great image for this text.
Yeah. Well, as I paraphrased it in terms of these untils, right? How long? And God answers, until the tailings leach enough that there needs to be remediation, until summer villagers must abandon the village for mine remediation to come in, until only the small staff on the village remains, and then a fire, and then a stump, right? Or as we've come up the valley, a lot of burned out trunks, right? The sense there of devastation, right? And again, perhaps unlike for the situation here at Holden, but it's this sense here that we first have to ask, do you think God wills this failure? I mean, again, look in verses 9 and 10. What does God want Isaiah to do?
Not pay attention to anybody, the people that are not listening and don't want to hear it, and it doesn't matter if they're
But it's as though God is telling Isaiah, it's your job to make sure they don't pay attention. My job here today is to make sure none of you pay attention to this, that you totally do not understand what's going on in the Bible. And if you leave and say, you know, I am more confused than ever, I'll say, thank you. I've done my job.
Yeah.
How's that?
Depressing. Discouraging.
It's depressing.
It's depressing.
And it seems sort of the opposite or different than yesterday, talking about Emmaus Road. Like, they were slow of heart, but Jesus wanted them to eventually recognize. And this is like, no, I don't want them to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if we stick with those metaphors, right? Here's another phrase. Today you're supposed to be fat of heart, right? In other words, your heart is surrounded with fat. Give these people congestive heart failure.
Well, that's one way to shake people out of normalcy, to be able to see differently. Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes the way we look at things differently is when stuff like that happens, suffering, not being able to see, a forest burning down, trucks driving all over, sometimes that helps us to look differently.
Okay. So you're thinking it's beneficial, it's not just depressing. What do others think? How are we supposed to understand these verses of the commissioning? Is this our normal expectation of God? That God wills failure? God wills, if you will, that you do not repent, that you are not healed, maybe more radically, not saved.
This reminds me of the what I sort of understand has been going on in the White House, where there was an interest in tearing down the existing structure so that you can rebuild a new structure. Is that part of this? Like laying waste to getting rid of, cleansing, taking it down so you can build up?
Might be.
In the New Testament, there's the theology of the cross that comes out of the New Testament, wherein our weakness is the point where God is able to come to us. But this is Old Testament, and I don't know.
Yes. But Luther, for example, got a lot of that theology of the cross from the Hebrew Scriptures. Mm-hmm. Particularly from the Psalms and from Isaiah.
I think it's a struggle for us to try to think of God in something and other ways of causing, give and I take, kind of the Job sense of, we try to rationalize away some of that.
Well, we were talking about Bonhoeffer earlier, maybe I think a question here to say, is this God's response to people who live by cheap grace? By folks who say, oh, well, you know, God's God, so God's got to love us. God's got to be on our side. God's always got to protect us. And it doesn't make any difference what we do. God's got to be good. God's got to be nice. And God may be saying, who says that's the way I have to behave? It's a challenging statement, right? And of course, Isaiah isn't happy with the commissioning either.
Right.
That response, how long, is basically saying, hey, you know, initially I was hesitant to volunteer to begin with, and now this, I did not volunteer for this. Right. Didn't come up to be a worker bee and do snaps. Come on. That wasn't in the contract. Anyway, right, that kind of thing that is there. Also the notion about how long, right, is again Isaiah's polite way, I would say, of suggesting that God is unfair. Is this the way you should be treating me? Is this the way you should be treating your people? That how long question within the tradition of Israel, particularly within the Psalms, has always been a question of lament, of complaint. Just to look at one place to get an example of where that happens. Psalm 13. Verses 1 to 3. Probably one of the best known psalms of lament that has this sense of how long. So when someone gets to Psalm 13, verses 1 to 3, if they would please read it for us.
How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I bear pain in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all day long? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? Consider and answer me, O Lord my God. Give light to my eyes, or I will sleep the sleep of death. Do you want me to read 4 too?
Thank you, David. Right? No, that's it. How long, right? For how long will you forget me? Situation we sometimes find ourselves in, isn't it? Feel forgotten, abandoned, neglected by God. And that sense, too, that it's really not fair. That whether it's something we did or didn't do or whatever, God is supposed to be big enough that God won't neglect us, forget us, abandon us. How long? How long is this going to go on? It seems like the relationship between God and Israel has been terminated. But is that moment of negation also one of the beginning? Don't know yet. But the interesting thing is that this commissioning of Isaiah, particularly verses 9 and 10, are quoted in all the Gospels. So if we'll look at this, Matthew 13, we'll look at a longer section here, verses 10 to 15. It's also in Mark 4:12. It's in Luke 8:10. It's in John 12. 37 to 43, and it's in Acts. So Paul gets in on this as well. Verses 16 to 28. And these three are all similar. So we'll look first at Matthew chapter 13. And Matthew chapter 13 begins with the parable of the sower and the seed. Or I think more accurately, the sower and the soils. And you know that parable that the sower goes out and sows seed, and some falls on the path, and some falls on rocky ground, and some on weedy ground, and some on good soil, and so on and so forth. So, Jesus tells that parable, and then, verse 10 of chapter 13, then the disciples came and asked him, "Why do you speak to them in parables?" He answered, "To you it has been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given. For to those who have more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. The reason I speak to them in parables is that," here you go, "seeing they do not perceive, and hearing they do not listen, nor do they understand. With them indeed is fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah that says, 'You will indeed listen, but the,'" and there's the quotation there from Isaiah verses 9 and 10. So, what's going on there? Jesus is saying, "I'm talking to them in parables so that, again, you don't understand."
So that they don't understand, or because they don't? It sounded more like because, but the other one was so.
Well,
so that they may not.
Verse 11, "To you it has been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given." And then, "The reason I speak to them in parables is that seeing they do not perceive, hearing they do not listen, nor do they understand."
So the key is to have these secrets. To be given the secret of heaven, isn't that what it says?
Yeah, Jesus says that to you has been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven. But all those other folks, they're not going to listen, they're not going to understand, they're going to be confused.
Seems to be predestination.
Okay. Anybody else?
Does it stay that way? Which side are we on?
Well, that's a great question, isn't it? Do I get to decide which side you're on? Well, would that be fun?
I always liked you, Michael.
One thing that kind of struck me is that in the Isaiah chapter, God says, "Go and tell this people." And then it's the be ever hearing but never understanding and so forth. Mm-hmm. And then we get to hear and it becomes Isaiah's prophesied this.
Mm-hmm.
I could kind of read the first one almost like, go tell them, you know, you're not hearing, you're not, you know, it's sort of a smart aleck sort of a statement. And then we come to where it's the prophecy that this is what they, this is how they are, or, you know, how people are. Is that, it just seems a little incongruous the way it's been changed, or the way it's in the gospel.
So those gospel writers are playing fast and loose with the text. Huh?
Well, obviously, we're reading a, you know, interpretation of it, right? And so,
see, I'm doing a great job of confusing you, right? You're all thinking, why couldn't he pick an easier?
We hear, but we don't understand.
Right? Yeah. What else do you think is happening here?
Thank you.
We'll have to read the next one. The Mark or the Luke?
No, because Mark and Luke, it's the same setup. They're the three, these first three Gospels, it's all tell the parable of the sower and the seed. The disciples say, we don't get it. And Jesus then gives this quotation from Isaiah and then explains the parable. But we could go to John, because we know John always tells things clearly. John chapter 12, verses 37 to 43.
Listen, it's ironic that he says to his disciples, they say, we don't get it. And he says, oh, but to you it's given the secret. And it's to the other people that don't get it, only the disciples that said, no, we don't get it.
I know, yeah. John 12, 37 to 43 reads, again, although he had performed so many signs in their presence, they did not believe in him. This was to fulfill the words spoken by the prophet Isaiah. Lord, who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? And so they could not believe, because Isaiah also said, he has blinded their eyes, hardened their hearts, so that they might not look with their eyes and understand with their heart and turn, and I would heal them. Isaiah said this because he saw his glory and spoke about him. Nevertheless, many, even of the authorities, believed in him. But because of the Pharisees, they did not confess it for fear that they would be put out of the synagogue, for they loved human glory more than the glory that comes from God. Okay, so there, verse 40 is the quotation again from Isaiah. Here, the context, right, it's different than a parable. This is Jesus performing signs. Signs in John is the word for miracles. And even though all these signs happened, and remember, one day we looked at one of that first sign, the wedding at Cana, turning water to wine, they don't believe. And but John again says, but of course that's to be expected, because after all, Isaiah told us that's what would happen. So, does that help explain any of this?
Not yet.
You guess.
You have a stump.
That's right.
I'm not understanding it, but one thing I think is interesting back in Isaiah, it says, keep listening and do not comprehend, keep looking and understand. I think my understanding is, like, in the Hebrew sense, to truly listen to something is to know it and to do it. You haven't really heard it if you're not doing it. So I just think it's interesting, and seems like God could be pretty exasperated. Like, yeah, keep doing that, like someone was saying, about almost like a sarcastic kind of thing. It still doesn't help me understand this, but.
No, but that's right. That's getting there, right? It's the whole, it's the issue again, as I've been pushing hard, that a sense of beginning, right? When do we know that something begins? With a notion of recognition, right? Again, our disciples on the way to Emmaus, that finally the beginning of the Christian community, the community of faith, happens when they recognize that stranger walking with them is the resurrected Christ. Right. Same here, the problem is the people lack recognition. And that indeed you can say, all right, the prophet's commission, even Jesus is talking here, I'm talking in parables, and it's so they don't recognize, yes, but the question there is to say, why don't they recognize? or to say, whose fault is it that they don't recognize? Is it Jesus' fault because he's talking to them in confusing parables? And in a minute you'll probably say, yes, it is. Or is something else going there, right? John isn't happy with just leaving that with a question, right? He does want to give us a little bit of an explanation. Verse 43, for they loved human glory more than the glory that comes from God. What does that mean? How do you understand that?
The human glory that they get from being a part of the temple and part of that whole culture and having good standing there. And
okay.
Whereas if they separated themselves from that and followed Jesus, then they would not have any of that human pomp and circumstance and glory.
Okay, so that, right, the human glory is that sense of honor
and respect
of authority.
Yeah. Power.
Power.
Status,
yeah.
Status and respect from other people.
And those are all things that you work on yourself, that you bring about through your own attainment.
So why is all that stuff going to prevent you from recognizing what Jesus has to say?
Because he might get all the glory and the power and the status.
All right, and what's so bad about that?
Then they won't have it. And that's what they want.
Okay. So that again, right, there it is. Whole sense of begin, right? You have to begin over.
Yeah.
If you take what Jesus says seriously, right? All this stuff has to go.
Yeah, and you have to humble yourself.
You think about all the work that's gone into getting where you're at, to let go of all that.
So all that stuff that you've tried to build, work for so long, up in flames. Burnt out stump. And now, you got to begin again. Totally different way. How many of you want to start over? Right? Especially when you get to be my age, 27. Hard to start over, isn't it? Right? You've set in your ways. You've worked so hard to try to find a few things that you think hold together, and you figured a few things out, and sorry.
Your kids come along.
Huh?
Your kids come along.
Yeah. Everything else. They come, they go, they come again. Right?
So is this like Joseph calls this cruciform life, where the old has to die, the old Adam, or Paul, the old Adam.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, it's the theology of the cross.
Yeah. Yep.
It's flat out, nothing left to give.
It's all got to go. And if we read Acts at the end of the act, we'll see the same thing there, right? Again, it's all got to go. It ends with, right, Paul is in prison. He's in Rome. He's under house arrest. The Jewish leaders from the Roman synagogues want to meet with Paul, and they come over and they have great debates and discussions about the scriptures and how, again, as we said yesterday, they point to Jesus as the Messiah who must suffer, die, rise again, and they just say, no, can't go there, don't get it. And so Paul kind of says, and see, and that's why I went to the Gentiles. Right? Because some of them, if you will, were ready to begin again.
What does this tell us about Jesus?
In terms of...
Well, I'm thinking about Luther talking about who died on the cross, and God died on the cross.
Yeah.
And it's not just kind of a, oh, his spirit went off. God died. And so God gave up everything, all honor and power and authority, for ultimate salvation and reconciliation.
Yeah. We could say perhaps God too must begin again.
Right. And Noah just didn't do it.
Who?
Noah.
Yeah. All right. So we're getting there. Recognition. All of that. Don't get it. How does that work? One more place that we'll take a look and try to pull it together here is Luke. Chapter 13, verses 1 to 9. Luke 13, 1 to 9. And I'll first read it again here from the NRSV, and then we can look at things. And what I really want to concentrate on is the parable, but we need to get the background here first. So, chapter 13 of Luke, verse 1. At that very time, there were some present who told him about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. He asked them, "Do you think that because these Galileans suffered in this way, they were worse sinners than all other Galileans? No, I tell you, but unless you repent, you will all perish as they did. Or those 18 who were killed when the Tower of Siloam fell on them. Do you think that they were worse offenders than all others living in Jerusalem? No, I tell you, but unless you repent, you will all perish, just as they did." Then he told this parable. A man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard, and he came looking for fruit on it and found none. So he said to the gardener, "See here, for 3 years I have come looking for fruit on this fig tree, and still I find none. Cut it down. Why should it be wasting the soil?" He replied, "Sir, let it alone for one more year until I dig around it and put manure on it. If it bears fruit next year, well and good. But if not, you can cut it down." There we go. So, the context,
right,
is a question about, is there a direct correlation between sin and punishment, or bad things that happen to you, right? I mean, verse 1 talks about a terrible atrocity, right? That apparently what Pilate did, and again suggesting here, it's the time of the Passover. It's the day of preparation when you slaughter the Passover lamb. And on that day, Pilate, for whatever reason, went out and killed some of the Galileans that were there worshiping at the temple and mingled their blood with the blood of the Passover lambs. Right. So, right. why those people were killed, we don't know, but I mean, that was just making fun of the whole Jewish religion, right? To mingle that blood together, that kind of atrocity. This tower falls on some people, and so the kind of cause and effect notion there is, well, if bad things happen to you, that must be because you did bad things, because you're a terrible sinner. Right? But the problem there, and as Jesus points out, you're arguing from effect to cause. And that is always an invalid argument, because just because simply knowing the effect, right? We'll just summarize. In either case, you're dead. You don't know precisely what the cause is for that, right? It could be all sorts of things, right? It might be because of a particular action you did, or it might be you were in the wrong place at the wrong time, or it might be who knows what. So you cannot draw this kind of conclusion. As well, Jesus very subtly shifts it from saying, you know, don't think about those people as sinners. Think about yourself. Mm-hmm. Right? You're sinners too. So is this what's going to happen to you? If you're not fruitful, what's going to happen? And so I'm going to tell you a parable. And it's going to be a parable about a fig tree. And one thing we need to know about fig trees here is that within the Jewish context and understanding, fig trees are a symbol of blessing and of an abundant future. The two fruits that have always symbolized blessing and abundant future in the Hebrew understanding here is, of course, first and foremost, grapes and abundant wine, and secondly, fig trees. Right. So we're supposed to have an abundant future with a fig tree. But now here we have a parable, this parable of the fig tree. And right, the first is, we can break it into various scenes. The first is scene one, which is verses 6 and 7. A man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard, and he came looking for fruit on it and found none. So he said to the gardener, "See here, for 3 years I have come looking for fruit on this fig tree, and still I find none. Cut it down. Why should it be wasting the soil?" If the parable would stop there, what would be the meaning?
Yeah.
Yep. If you don't produce, you die. Right? If you can't bear fruit, you're done for. Right?
Yeah, if you don't give a fig.
So this is the warning, right? You better not fail to produce, all you work week volunteers, you worker bees. By the time tomorrow evening rolls around, we want to see results from these 4 days of work, right? You're not up here for a good time, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's not a snack, right?
The other thing that is here that we need to think about is with regard to this owner. And if we try to figure out exactly what's going on, folks say, who know more about fig trees than I do, that it would take 3 years from planting the tree before it would initially bear fruit. Then there's another 3 years where, according to Leviticus, the first 3 years of a fruit tree bearing fruit, the fruit is considered unclean. You're not supposed to harvest it. Leave it alone. And so, nothing there. And now we hear from the passage, for how long has the vineyard owner, the orchard owner, come around to look for fruit?
3 years.
3 years. So, the miracle of addition. The owner is saying, I've been waiting 9 years for this sucker to be fruitful. So, is it unreasonable for the owner to say, cut it down? What do you think? No. John says, no. Don says, no. All the lawns and garden people say, no.
No.
No. It's not unreasonable at all. Of course, cut it down. Because not only is it fruitless, but what else? It's taken up other soil. So how would we describe that?
Opportunity cost.
Greedy. Right. Sure. Or it's parasitic. Right. It's taking up other people's resources. And so therefore, right, we have all of those reasons this tree's gotta go. And it seems perfectly reasonable to say that. Okay. Scene 2, verses 8 and 9. And again, he replied, sir, let it alone for one more year until I dig around it and put manure on it. If it bears fruit next year, well and good. But if not, you can cut it down. All right. A few things about translation here, particularly with regard to verse 9. Right. Verse 9 is, first of all, if it bears fruit next year, that really isn't what the text says. It says, if it bears fruit into the future. In other words, the vine dresser, the orchard keeper, doesn't even want to stipulate next year. We assume next year because the owner keeps coming back every year. And then, and here, oh, big argument there. Well and good? It's not in the Greek text. Our translators, Bruce Metzger in this case, doesn't like gaps. What we have here, the text itself says, if it bears fruit into the future, if you will, I think the proper grammar there is dot, 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 an ellipsis. And then comes the second one. But if not, right? And that's there. If not, but note there again, you, and in Greek the you is emphatic, you can cut it down. Now, right? What I think is the most interesting part of this whole thing is the ellipsis. Precisely what our NRSV translators didn't want to leave open-ended. Right? If it bears fruit into the future, right? What do you do? Right? Just there, nothing more. Open, right? As a Bible study the other night, as we were talking about the sense of, right? What have we got here? Just a space.
Yeah.
Just space. Open. Yeah. As I like to think about it, right? This ellipsis is space for grace. This ellipsis is the place where something can happen. This is where, if you will, that tree could make a new beginning. As impossible as that seems, because after all, 9 years, we're talking barren, ladies and gentlemen.
All it takes
fruitless.
Is a little manure. Yeah. All it takes is a little manure.
All it takes is a little manure. Well, maybe. If you'd have a fruit tree that hasn't borne any fruit in 9 years, how much manure are you going to put on it? Right? Scene 3. Would you like to read scene 3 for me? There is no scene.
Yeah. We've gone through that verse 9, and that's all you have us going through.
Right? We don't know how this story ends, right? Again, open space, right? All we have here is the suggestion of what the steward, the vine dresser, the orchardist is going to do. Going to dig around it, going to manure it. Right? Extraordinary efforts, especially the manure, because that's not a common practice in the sense, right? Again, folks don't have that much livestock, and often because of wood shortages and those things, the manure that would come from cattle, oxen, camels would often be used for cooking fires. So again, from a very pragmatic perspective, Jesus' hearers are going, what's the matter with this vine dresser? Right? We got a useless tree, and he's going to use good fuel material on something useless? Whew. What's going through that guy's head? Right? So you see, again, the extraordinary work that this dresser is willing to go to for the sake of this barren tree. Scene 3, well, that's for you to write. So, my question there would be, who are you rooting for?
Nah.
You're rooting for the owner. You're rooting for the orchardist. You're rooting for the tree. Who are you rooting for? You're rooting for the tree.
Yes.
Why are you rooting for the tree?
I want it to live.
You want it to live.
I want it to produce. I want it to grow. I want to see it for myself.
Okay.
She's a tree hugger.
I am. I'm a gardener, so I'm going to make that sucker grow. I'm going to tend it and water it and manure it and go out and check it all the time. And tell the owner to go away.
Despite the fact of 9 years of failure.
Well, in my house, it would be the gophers taking over. And I, you know, I'd transplant the thing and I'd be, yeah.
What about others? Who are you rooting for?
Well, we're in the orchard business and we're always rooting for the orchard, to get something productive. And so we'd probably be rooting for the land.
You're rooting for the land.
We'd be farming out with a D8 cat. Starting over. Because you put fertilizer on it, all does grow more. You just got more shade. You're still
yeah, more it. Leaves.
It's not
going to
change. It's not going to change the tree.
Sounds like an owner to me.
I think one of my thoughts is, you know, part of the tension of why put more manure on it or why let it live is the assumption of scarcity too, right? There's only so much, so why waste it on that? But I think maybe that's some of what God and Jesus are saying in the parables is like, no, it's not a scarcity thing, it's abundance in my kingdom. So, yeah. Everyone for the manure.
Well, we're up closer. But, okay, a sidelight. One thing about the manure, and that is, of course, often with parables in the history of the tradition of interpreting parables, certainly early church into the medieval church and whatnot, folks often allegorized parables, right? And again, that's really not a good way to interpret it. But for what it's worth, a common allegory of this parable would be that the orchard owner would be who?
God.
The orchardist would be who?
Jesus.
The tree would be any one of us, of course. Who's the manure? Who is the manure?
Gospel. Holy Spirit.
No.
Wouldn't it be the
grace.
Nope.
Grace.
God's grace.
Nope.
No.
The Holy Spirit.
Nope. The church. Spirit.
Church.
The church.
I knew that, so that's my job.
So, to be very crass for a moment, I can get away with this by saying, as a compliment to all of you, you are shit. And actually, Luther had a sermon on that. It's one of his sermons that is not in the American and in the English translation. All the really good scatological sermons that Luther preached, They're only still in Latin. So if you want to read the "You Are Shit" sermon, you'll have to learn Latin. But that is, and I mean, Sir, think about that, right? I mean, indeed, isn't that who or what our function is as those who bear the gospel, bring the gospel, live the gospel? It is to try to nourish those who seem helpless, fruitless, barren, failures in life. And that. So, I mean, you know, it's not a, in that sense, right, it's not a an insult in this one instance to be called manure. So there you go. But there, it's, again, right, a sense of trying to hold out hope for again a beginning for this tree that seems absolutely barren and fruitless.
So I'm seeing the next funeral, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, and you are, or you were,
manure.
And you are.
Yep.
And this was good background for what I need to do at 6, so it's not directly related, but...
That's right. We've been working together for months to make sure every sentence we say is complimentary.
But I have to eat or I'm not going to be...
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.